Shambhala Lion Editions presents Memories, Dreams, Reflections by Carl Jung. Read for you by Michael York.
Prologue. My life is the story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation, and the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole. I cannot employ the language of science to trace this process of growth in myself, for I cannot experience myself as a scientific problem. Thus it is that I have now undertaken, in my 83rd year, to tell my personal myth. I can only make direct statements, only tell stories. Whether or not the stories are true is not the problem. The only question is whether what I tell is my fable, my truth. Life has always seemed to me like a plant that lives on its rhizome or root. Its true life is invisible, hidden in the rhizome. The part that appears above ground lasts only a single summer. Then it withers away, an ephemeral apparition. When we think of the unending growth and decay of life and civilizations, we cannot escape the impression of absolute nullity. Yet I have never lost a sense of something that lives and endures underneath the eternal flux. What we see is the blossom which passes. The rhizome remains. In the end, the only events in my life worth telling are those when the imperishable world erupted into this transitory one. That is why I speak chiefly of inner experiences, amongst which I include my dreams and visions. These form the prima materia of my scientific work. They were the fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. First years. When I was 6 months old, my parents moved from Kessville on Lake Constance to Laufen, the castle and vicarage above the falls of the Rhine. This was in 1875. My memories begin with my second or third year. I recall the vicarage, the garden, the laundry house, the church, the castle, the falls, the small castle of Vught, and the sexton's farm. These are nothing but islands of memory afloat in a sea of vagueness, each by itself, apparently with no connection between them. One memory comes up, which is perhaps the earliest of my life, and is indeed only a rather hazy impression. I am lying in a pram, in the shadow of a tree. It is a fine, warm summer day, the sky blue and golden sunlight darting through the green leaves. The hood of the pram has been left up. I have just awakened to the glorious beauty of the day, and have a sense of indescribable well-being. I see the sun glittering through the leaves and blossoms of the bushes. Everything is wholly wonderful, colorful, and splendid. Yet another image. I am restive, feverish, unable to sleep. My father carries me in his arms, paces up and down, singing his old student songs. To this day I can remember my father's voice singing over me in the stillness of the night. I was suffering, so my mother told me afterward, from general eczema. Dim intimations of trouble in my parents' marriage hovered around me. My illness, in 1878, must have been connected with a temporary separation of my parents. My mother spent several months in a hospital in Basel, and presumably her illness had something to do with the difficulty in the marriage. An aunt of mine, who was a spinster and some 20 years older than my mother, took care of me. I was deeply troubled by my mother's being away. From then on, I always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken. The feeling I associated with woman was for a long time that of innate unreliability. Father, on the other hand, meant reliability and powerlessness. That is the handicap I started off with. Later, these early impressions were revised. I have trusted men, friends, and been disappointed by them. And I have mistrusted women, and was not disappointed. These are my outward memories. What follows now are more powerful, indeed overwhelming images, some of which I recall only dimly. At about the same time, I had the earliest dream I can remember, a dream which was to preoccupy me all my life. I was then between 3 and 4 years old. The vicarage stood quite alone near Laufen Castle, and there was a big meadow stretching back from the sexton's farm. In the dream, I was in this meadow. Suddenly I discovered a dark, rectangular, stone-lined hole in the ground. I had never seen it before. I ran forward curiously and peered down into it. Then I saw a stone stairway leading down. Hesitantly and fearfully, I descended. At the bottom was a doorway with a round arch closed off by a green curtain. It was a big, heavy curtain of material like brocade, and it looked very sumptuous. Curious to see what might be hidden behind, I pushed it aside. I saw before me in the dim light a rectangular chamber about 30 feet long. The ceiling was arched and of hewn stone. The floor was laid with flagstones, and in the center a red carpet ran from the entrance to a low platform. On this platform stood a wonderfully rich golden throne. I am not certain, but perhaps a red cushion lay on the seat. It was a magnificent throne, a real king's throne in a fairy tale. Something was standing on it, which I thought at first was a tree trunk 12 to 15 feet high and about 1.5 to 2 feet thick. It was a huge thing, reaching almost to the ceiling. But it was of a curious composition. It was made of skin and naked flesh, and on top there was something like a rounded head with no face and no hair. On the very top of the head was a single eye, gazing motionlessly upward. It was fairly light in the room, although there were no windows and no apparent source of light. Above the head, however, was an aura of brightness. The thing did not move, yet I had the feeling that it might at any moment crawl off the throne like a worm and creep toward me. I was paralyzed with terror. At that moment I heard from outside and above me my mother's voice. She called out, "Yes, just look at him. That is the man-eater." That intensified my terror still more, and I awoke, sweating and scared to death. For many nights afterward I was afraid to go to sleep, because I feared I might have another dream like that one. This dream haunted me for years. Only much later did I realize that what I had seen was a phallus, and it was decades before I understood that it was a ritual phallus. The abstract significance of the phallus is shown by the fact that it was enthroned by itself. The hole in the meadow probably represented a grave. The grave itself was an underground temple whose green curtain symbolized the meadow. In other words, the mystery of earth with her covering of green vegetation. The carpet was blood red. What about the vault? Perhaps I had been to the Mühnel, the citadel of Schaffhausen. This is not likely, since no one would take a 3-year-old child up there, so it cannot be a memory trace. Equally, I do not know where the anatomically correct phallus can have come from. The interpretation of the urethral orifice as an eye, with a source of light apparently above it, points to the etymology of the phallus, meaning shining or bright. Through this childhood dream, I was initiated into the secrets of the earth. What happened then was a kind of burial in the earth, and many years were to pass before I came out again. Today I know that it happened in order to bring the greatest possible amount of light into the darkness. It was an initiation into the realm of darkness. My intellectual life had its unconscious beginnings at that time. Soon after I was 6, my father began giving me Latin lessons, and I also went to school. I did not mind school. It was easy for me, since I was always ahead of the others and had learned to read before I went there. However, I remember a time when I could not read, but pestered my mother to read aloud to me out of the Orbis Pictus, an old, richly illustrated children's book, which contained an account of exotic religions, especially that of the Hindus. There were illustrations of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, which I found an inexhaustible source of interest. My mother later told me that I always returned to these pictures. Whenever I did so, I had an obscure feeling of their affinity with my original revelation, which I never spoke of to anyone. It was a secret I must never betray. Indirectly, my mother confirmed this feeling, for the faint tone of contempt with which she spoke of heathens did not escape me. I knew that she would reject my revelation with horror, and I did not want to expose myself to any such injury. This unchildlike behavior was connected, on the one hand, with an intense sensitivity and vulnerability, and on the other hand, and this especially, with the loneliness of my early youth. My sister was born 9 years after me, so I played alone and in my own way. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I played. I recall only that I did not want to be disturbed. One of my reasons for liking school was that there I found at last the playmates I had lacked for so long. At school, I also discovered something else. But before I go into this, I should first mention that the nocturnal atmosphere had begun to thicken. All sorts of things were happening at night, things incomprehensible and alarming. My parents were sleeping apart. I slept in my father's room. From the door to my mother's room came frightening influences. At night, mother was strange and mysterious. One night, I saw coming from her door a faintly luminous, indefinite figure whose head detached itself from the neck and floated along in front of it, in the air, like a little moon. Immediately, another head was produced and again detached itself. This process was repeated 6 or 7 times. I had anxiety dreams of things that were now small, now large. For instance, I saw a tiny ball at a great distance. Gradually it approached, growing steadily into a monstrous and suffocating object. Or I saw telegraph wires with birds sitting on them, and the wires grew thicker, and my fear greater, until the terror woke me. Although these dreams were overtures to the physiological changes of puberty, they had in their turn a prelude which occurred about my 7th year. At that time I was sick with pseudo-croup, accompanied by choking fits. One night, during an attack, I stood at the foot of the bed, my head bent back over the bed rail, while my father held me under the arms. Above me, I saw a glowing blue circle about the size of the full moon, and inside it moved golden figures, which I thought were angels. This vision was repeated, and each time it allayed my fears of suffocation. But the suffocation returned in the anxiety dreams. I see in this a psychogenic factor. The atmosphere of the house was beginning to be unbreathable. I had in those days a yellow varnished pencil case, of the kind commonly used by primary school pupils, with a little lock and the customary ruler. At the end of this ruler, I now carved a little mannequin, about 2 inches long, with frock coat, top hat, and shiny black boots. I colored him black with ink, sawed him off the ruler, and put him in the pencil case, where I made him a little bed. I even made a coat for him out of a bit of wool. In the case, I also placed a smooth, oblong, blackish stone from the Rhine, which I had painted with watercolors to look as though it were divided into an upper and lower half, and had long carried around in my trouser pocket. This was his stone. All this was a great secret. I took the case to the attic at the top of the house and hid it with great satisfaction on one of the beams under the roof, for no one must ever see it. I knew that not a soul would ever find it there. No one could discover my secret and destroy it. I felt safe, and the tormenting sense of being at odds with myself was gone. In all difficult situations, whenever I had done something wrong, or my feelings had been hurt, or when my father's irritability or my mother's invalidism oppressed me, I thought of my carefully bedded down and wrapped up mannequin and his smooth, prettily colored stone. From time to time, often at intervals of weeks, I secretly stole up to the attic when I could be certain that no one would see me. Then I clambered up on the beam, opened the case, and looked at my mannequin and his stone. Each time I did this, I placed in the case a little scroll of paper on which I had previously written something during school hours in a secret language of my own invention. The addition of a new scroll always had the character of a solemn ceremonial act. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I wanted to communicate to the mannequin. I only know that my letters constituted a kind of library for him. I fancy, though I cannot be certain, that they may have consisted of sayings that particularly pleased me. The meanings of these actions, or how I might explain them, never worried me. I contented myself with the feeling of newly won security, and was satisfied to possess something that no one knew and no one could get at. It was an inviolable secret, which must never be betrayed, for the safety of my life depended on it. Why that was so, I did not ask myself. It was simply so. This possession of a secret had a very powerful formative influence on my character. I consider it the essential factor of my boyhood. Similarly, I never told anyone about the dream of the phallus. The little wooden figure with the stone was a first attempt, still unconscious and childish, to give shape to the secret. I was always absorbed by it, and had the feeling I ought to fathom it, and yet I did not know what it was I was trying to express. I always hoped I might be able to find something, perhaps in nature, that would give me the clue and show me where or what the secret was. At that time my interest in plants, animals, and stones grew. I was constantly on the lookout for something mysterious. Consciously, I was religious in the Christian sense, though always with the reservation, "But it is not so certain as all that," or "What about that thing under the ground?" And when religious teachings were pumped into me and I was told, "This is beautiful and this is good," I would think to myself, "Yes, but there is something else, something very secret that people don't know about." The episode with the carved mannequin formed the climax and conclusion of my childhood. It lasted about a year. Thereafter, I completely forgot the whole affair until I was 35. Then this fragment of memory rose up again from the mists of childhood with pristine clarity. While I was engaged on the preliminary studies for my book, Symbols and Transformation, I read about the cache of soul stones near Alsheim and the Australian Turingus. I suddenly discovered that I had a quite definite image of such a stone, though I had never seen any reproductions. It was oblong, blackish, and painted into an upper and lower half. This image was joined by that of the pencil box and the mannequin. The mannequin was a little cloaked god of the ancient world, a Telesphorus, such as stands on the monument of Asclepios, and reads to him from a scroll. Along with this recollection there came to me, for the first time, the conviction that there are archaic psychic components which have entered the individual psyche without any direct line of tradition. School years. One day in the early summer of 1887, when I was 12 years old, I was standing in the cathedral square, waiting for a classmate who went home by the same route as myself. It was 12 o'clock, and the morning classes were over. Suddenly, another boy gave me a shove that knocked me off my feet. I fell, striking my head against the curbstone so hard that I almost lost consciousness. At the moment I felt the blow, the thought flashed through my mind, "Now you won't have to go to school any more." I was only half unconscious, but I remained lying there a few moments longer than was strictly necessary, chiefly in order to avenge myself on my assailant. Then people picked me up and took me to a house nearby, where two elderly spinster aunts lived. From then on, I began to have fainting spells whenever I had to return to school, and whenever my parents set me to doing my homework. For more than 6 months, I stayed away from school, and for me, that was a picnic. I was free, could dream for hours, be anywhere I liked, in the woods or by the water, or draw. Above all, I was able to plunge into the world of the mysterious. To that realm belonged trees, a pool, a swamp, stones and animals, and my father's library. But I was growing more and more away from the world, and had all the while faint pangs of conscience. I frittered away my time with loafing, collecting, reading, and playing, but I did not feel any happier for it. I had the obscure feeling that I was fleeing from myself. I forgot completely how all this had come about, but I pitied my parents' worries. They consulted various doctors, who scratched their heads and packed me off to spend the holidays with relatives in Winterthur. This city had a railroad station that proved a source of endless delight to me. But when I returned home, everything was as before. One doctor thought I had epilepsy. I knew what epileptic fits were like, and I inwardly laughed at such nonsense. My parents became more worried than ever. Then one day, a friend called on my father. They were sitting in the garden, and I hid behind a shrub, for I was possessed of an insatiable curiosity. I heard the visitor saying to my father, "And how is your son?" "Ah, that's a sad business," my father replied. "The doctors no longer know what is wrong with him. They think it may be epilepsy. It would be dreadful if he were incurable. I have lost what little I had, and what will become of the boy if he cannot earn his own living?" I was thunderstruck. This was the collision with reality. "Why, then I must get to work," I thought suddenly. From that moment on, I became a serious child. I crept away, went to my father's study, took out my Latin grammar, and began to cram with intense concentration. After 10 minutes of this, I had the finest of fainting fits. I almost fell off the chair, but after a few minutes I felt better, and went on working. "Devil take it, I'm not going to faint," I told myself, and persisted in my purpose. This time it took about 15 minutes before the second attack came. That, too, passed like the first. "And now you must really get to work," I told myself. I stuck it out, and after an hour came the third attack. Still I did not give up, and worked for another hour, until I had the feeling that I had overcome the attacks. Suddenly I felt better than I had in all the months before. And in fact the attacks did not recur. From that day on, I worked over my grammar and other schoolbooks every day. That was when I learned what a neurosis is. Gradually the recollection of how it had all come about returned to me, and I saw clearly that I myself had arranged this whole disgraceful situation. I had a feeling of rage against myself, and at the same time was ashamed of myself. For I knew that I had wronged myself and made a fool of myself in my own eyes. Nobody else was to blame. I was the cursed renegade. What led me astray during the crisis was my passion for being alone, my delight in solitude. Nature seemed to me full of wonders, and I wanted to steep myself in them. Every stone, every plant, every single thing seemed alive and indescribably marvelous. I immersed myself in nature, crawled, as it were, into the very essence of nature, and away from the whole human world. One fine summer day, I came out of school at noon and went to the cathedral square. The sky was gloriously blue, the day one of radiant sunshine. The roof of the cathedral glittered, the sun sparkling from the new brightly glazed tiles. I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the sight and thought, "The world is beautiful and the church is beautiful, and God made all this and sits above it far away in the blue sky on a golden throne and..." Here came a great hole in my thoughts and a choking sensation. I felt numbed and knew only, "Don't go on thinking now. Something terrible is coming, something I do not want to think, something I dare not even approach." Why not? Because I would be committing the most frightful of sins. What is the most terrible sin? Murder? No, it can't be that. The most terrible sin is the sin against the Holy Ghost, which cannot be forgiven. Anyone who commits that sin is damned to hell for all eternity. That would be very sad for my parents if their only son, to whom they are so attached, should be doomed to eternal damnation. I cannot do that to my parents. All I need do is not go on thinking. That was easier said than done. On my long walk home, I tried to think all sorts of other things, but I found my thoughts returning again and again to the beautiful cathedral which I loved so much, and to God sitting on the throne, and then my thoughts would fly off again as if they had received a powerful electric shock. I reached home in a pretty worked-up state. My mother noticed that something was wrong and asked, "What is the matter with you? Has something happened at school?" I did have the thought that it might help me to confess to my mother the real reason for my turmoil. But to do so, I would have to do the very thing that seemed impossible, think my thought right to the end. That night I slept badly. Again and again the forbidden thought, which I did not yet know, tried to break out, and I struggled desperately to fend it off. The next 2 days were sheer torture, and my mother was convinced that I was ill. But I resisted the temptation to confess, aided by the thought that it would cause my parents intense sorrow. On the third night, however, the torment became so unbearable that I no longer knew what to do. I awoke from a restless sleep, just in time to catch myself thinking again about the cathedral and God. I had almost continued the thought. Sweating with fear, I sat up in bed to shake off sleep. Now it is coming. Now it's serious. I must think. It must be thought out beforehand. Why should I think something I don't know and don't want to know? Where does this terrible will come from? And why should I be the one to be subjected to it? I haven't done this or wanted this. It has come on me like a bad dream. Where do such things come from? This has happened to me without my doing. Why? After all, I didn't create myself. I came into this world the way God made me, that is, the way I was shaped by my parents. Or can it have been that my parents wanted something of this sort? But my good parents would never have had any thoughts like that. Nothing so atrocious would ever have occurred to them. I found this idea utterly absurd. Then I thought of my grandparents, whom I knew only from their portraits. They looked benevolent and dignified enough to repulse any idea that they might possibly be to blame. I mentally ran through the long procession of unknown ancestors until finally I arrived at Adam and Eve. And with them came the decisive thought. Adam and Eve were the first people. They had no parents, but they were created directly by God, who intentionally made them as they were. They had no choice but to be exactly the way God had created them. Therefore, they did not know how they could possibly be different. They were perfect creatures of God, for He creates only perfection. And yet, they committed the first sin by doing what God did not want them to do. How was that possible? they could not have done it if God had not placed in them the possibility of doing it. Therefore, it was God's intention that they should sin. This thought liberated me instantly from my worst torment, since I now knew that God Himself had placed me in this situation. At first, I did not know whether He intended me to commit my sin or not. What does God want? To act or not to act? I must find out what God wants with me, and I must find out right away. My broken sleep and my spiritual distress had worn me out to such a point that fending off the thought was tying me into unbearable knots. This could not go on. At the same time, I could not yield before I understood what God's will was and what He intended, for I was now certain that He was the author of this desperate problem. I knew, beyond a doubt, that I would ultimately be compelled to break down, to give way. But I did not want it to happen without my understanding it, since the salvation of my eternal soul was at stake. God knows that I cannot resist much longer, and He does not help me, although I am on the point of having to commit the unforgivable sin. In His omnipotence, He could easily lift this compulsion from me, but evidently He is not going to. Can it be that He wishes to test my obedience by imposing on me the unusual task of doing something against my own moral judgment and against His own commandment, something I am resisting with all my strength because I fear eternal damnation? Is it possible that God wishes to see whether I am capable of obeying His will, even though my faith and my reason raise before me the specters of death and hell? That might really be the answer. Obviously, God also desires me to show courage, I thought. If that is so, and I go through with it, then He will give me His grace and illumination. I gathered all my courage, as though I were about to leap forthwith into hell fire, and let the thought come. I saw before me the cathedral, the blue sky. God sits on His golden throne, high above the world, and under the throne an enormous turd falls upon the sparkling new roof, shatters it, and breaks the walls of the cathedral asunder. So that was it. I felt an enormous and indescribable relief. Instead of the expected damnation, grace had come upon me, and with it an unutterable bliss, such as I had never known. I wept for happiness and gratitude. The wisdom and goodness of God had been revealed to me now that I had yielded to His inexorable command. That was what my father had not understood, I thought. He had failed to experience the will of God, had opposed it for the best reasons and out of the deepest faith. And that is why he had never experienced the miracle of grace which heals all and makes all comprehensible. He did not know the immediate living God who stands omnipotent and free above His Bible and His church, who calls upon man to partake of his freedom and can force him to renounce his own views and convictions in order to fulfill without reserve the command of God. In His trial of human courage, God refuses to abide by traditions, no matter how sacred. In His omnipotence, He will see to it that nothing really evil comes of such tests of courage. If one fulfills the will of God, one can be sure of going the right way. It was obedience which brought me grace, and after that experience, I knew what God's grace was. One must be utterly abandoned to God. Nothing matters but fulfilling His will. Otherwise, all is folly and meaninglessness. With the experience of God and the cathedral, I at last had something tangible that was part of the great secret. As if I had always talked of stones falling from heaven, and now had one in my pocket. But actually, it was a shaming experience. I had fallen into something bad, something evil and sinister, though at the same time, It was a kind of distinction. Sometimes I had an overwhelming urge to speak, not about that, but only to hint that there were some curious things about me which no one knew of. I wanted to find out whether other people had undergone similar experiences. I never succeeded in discovering so much as a trace of them in others. As a result, I had the feeling that I was either outlawed or elect, accursed or blessed. Student years. I looked forward with longing to the end of my school days. Then I would go to the university and study. Natural science, of course. Then I would know something real. But no sooner had I made myself this promise than my doubts began. Was not my bent rather toward history and philosophy? Then again, I was intensely interested in everything Egyptian and Babylonian, and would have liked best to be an archaeologist. But I had no money to study anywhere except in Basel, and in Basel there was no teacher for this subject. So this plan very soon came to an end. For a long time I could not make up my mind, and constantly postponed the decision. My father was very worried. He said once, "The boy is interested in everything imaginable, and he does not know what he wants." I could only admit that he was right. As matriculation approached, and we had to decide what faculty to register for, I abruptly decided on science. But I left my schoolfellows in doubt as to whether I intended to go in definitely for science or the humanities. This apparently sudden decision had a background of its own. Some weeks previously, I had two dreams. In the first dream, I was in a dark wood that stretched along the Rhine. I came to a little hill, a burial mound, and began to dig. After a while I turned up, to my astonishment, some bones of prehistoric animals. This interested me enormously, and at that moment I knew I must get to know nature, the world in which we live, and the things around us. Then came a second dream. Again I was in a wood. It was threaded with watercourses, and in the darkest place I saw a circular pool surrounded by dense undergrowth. Half immersed in the water lay the strangest and most wonderful creature, a round animal shimmering in opalescent hues and consisting of innumerable little cells, or of organs shaped like tentacles. It was a giant radiolarian, measuring about 3 feet across. It seemed to me indescribably wonderful that this magnificent creature should be lying there undisturbed, in the hidden place, in the clear, deep water. It aroused in me an intense desire for knowledge, so that I awoke with a beating heart. These two dreams decided me overwhelmingly in favor of science, and removed all my doubts. It became clear to me that I was living in a time and a place where a person had to earn his living. To do so, one had to be this or that, and it made a deep impression on me that all my schoolfellows were imbued with this necessity and thought about nothing else. I felt I was in some way odd. I saw I would have to settle down and think the matter through. If I took up zoology, for instance, I could be only a schoolmaster, or at best an employee in a zoological garden. There was no future in that, even if one's demands were modest, though I would certainly have preferred working in a zoo to the life of a schoolteacher. In this blind alley, the inspiration suddenly came to me that I could study medicine. I told myself that the study of medicine, at least, began with scientific subjects. To that extent, I would be doing what I wanted. Moreover, the field of medicine was so broad that there was always the possibility of specializing later. I had definitely opted for science, and the only question was, how? I had to earn my living, and as I had no money, I could not attend a university abroad and obtain the kind of training that would give me hopes of a scientific career. At best, I could become only a dilettante in science. nor, since I possessed a personality that made me disliked by many of my schoolfellows and of the people who counted, that is, the teachers, was there any hope of finding a patron who would support my wish. When, therefore, I finally decided on medicine, it was with a rather disagreeable feeling that it was not a good thing to start life with such a compromise. Nevertheless, I felt considerably relieved now that this irrevocable decision had been made. Where was the money to come from? My father could raise only part of it. He applied to the University of Basel for a stipend for me, and to my shame, it was granted. I was ashamed, not so much because our poverty was laid bare for all the world to see, but because I had secretly been convinced that all the top people, the people who counted, were ill-disposed toward me. I'd never expected any such kindness from them. I had obviously profited by the reputation of my father, who was a good and uncomplicated person. Yet I felt myself totally different from him. I had, in fact, two different conceptions of myself. Through number one's eyes, I saw myself as a rather disagreeable and moderately gifted young man with vaulting ambitions, an undisciplined temperament, and dubious manners, alternating between naive enthusiasm and fits of childish disappointment, in his innermost essence a hermit and obscurantist. On the other hand, number two regarded number one as a difficult and thankless moral task, a lesson that had to be got through somehow, complicated by a variety of faults such as spells of laziness, despondency, depression, inept enthusiasm for ideas and things that nobody valued, liable to imaginary friendships, limited, prejudiced, stupid, with a lack of understanding for other people, vague and confused in philosophical matters, neither an honest Christian nor anything else. Number two had no definable character at all. He was a vita per acta, born, living, dead, everything in one, a total vision of life. Though pitilessly clear about himself, he was unable to express himself through the dense, dark medium of number one, though he longed to do so. Number two felt that any conceivable expression of himself would be like a stone thrown over the edge of the world, dropping soundlessly into infinite night. But in him light reigned, as in the spacious halls of a royal palace, whose high casements open upon a landscape flooded with sunlight. Here were meaning and historical continuity, in strong contrast to the incoherent fortuitousness of number one's life, which had no real points of contact with its environment. Number two, on the other hand, felt himself in secret accord with the Middle Ages, as personified by Faust, with the legacy of a past which had obviously stirred Goethe to the depths. For Goethe, too, therefore, and this was my great consolation, number two was a reality. Faust was the living equivalent of number two, and I was convinced that he was the answer which Goethe had given to his times. This insight was not only comforting to me, it also gave me an increased feeling of inner security and a sense of belonging to the human community. I was no longer isolated and a mere curiosity, a sport of cruel nature. About this time, I had a dream which both frightened me and encouraged me. It was night in some unknown place, and I was making slow and painful headway against a mighty wind. Dense fog was flying along everywhere. I had my hands cupped around a tiny light, which threatened to go out at any moment. Everything depended on my keeping this little light alive. Suddenly I had the feeling that something was coming up behind me. I looked back and saw a gigantic black figure following me. But at the same moment I was conscious, in spite of my terror, that I must keep my little light going through the night and wind, regardless of the dangers. When I awoke, I realized at once that the figure was my own shadow on the swirling mists, brought into being by the little light I was carrying. I knew, too, that this little light was my consciousness, the only light I have. My own understanding is the sole treasure I possess, and the greatest. This dream was a great illumination for me. Now I knew that number one was the bearer of the light, and that number two followed him like a shadow. My task was to shield the light and not look back at the Vita Peracta. This was evidently a forbidden realm of light of a different sort. I must go forward against the storm, which sought to thrust me back into the immeasurable darkness of a world where one is aware of nothing except the surfaces of things in the background. The storm pushing against me was time, ceaselessly flowing into the past, which just as ceaselessly dogs our heels. My view of the world spun around another 90 degrees. I recognized clearly that my path led irrevocably outward into the limitations and darkness of three-dimensionality. It seemed to me that Adam must once have left paradise in this manner. Eden had become a spectre for him, and light was where a stony field had to be tilled in the sweat of his brow. At any rate, a schism had taken place between me and number two, with the result that I was assigned to number one and was separated from number two in the same degree, who thereby acquired, as it were, an autonomous personality. I did not connect this with the idea of any definite individuality, although with my rustic origins this possibility would not have seemed strange to me. In the country, people believe in these things according to the circumstances. They are and they are not. The only distinct feature about this spirit was his historical character, his extension in time, or rather, his timelessness. Of course, I did not tell myself this in so many words, nor did I form any conception of his spatial existence. He played the role of a factor in the background of my number one existence, never clearly defined, but yet definitely present. During the years 1892 to 1894, I had a number of rather vehement discussions with my father. My mother avoided everything that might excite him and refused to engage in disputes. I would remain passive during his outbursts of rage, but when he seemed to be in a more accessible mood, I sometimes tried to strike up a conversation with him, hoping to learn something about his inner thoughts and his understanding of himself. It was clear to me that something quite specific was tormenting him, and I suspected that it had to do with his faith. This, it seemed to me, was bound to be the case if the necessary experience had not come to him. From my attempts at discussion, I learned, in fact, that something of the sort was amiss, for all my questions were met with the same old lifeless theological answers, or with a resigned shrug which aroused the spirit of contradiction in me. I could not understand why he did not seize on these opportunities pugnaciously and come to terms with his situation. He had to quarrel with somebody, so he did it with his family and himself. Why didn't he do it with God, the dark author of all created things, who alone was responsible for the sufferings of the world? God would assuredly have sent him by way of an answer one of those magical, infinitely profound dreams which he had sent to me without being asked, and which had sealed my fate. Theology had alienated my father and me from one another. I had a dim premonition that he was inescapably succumbing to his fate. He was lonely and had no friend to talk with. At least I knew no one among our acquaintances whom I would have trusted to say the saving word. Once I heard him praying. He struggled desperately to keep his faith. I was shaken and outraged at once, because I saw how hopelessly he was entrapped by the church and its theological thinking. They had blocked all avenues by which he might have reached God directly, and then faithlessly abandoned him. The arch sin of faith, it seemed to me, was that it forestalled experience. His depressive moods increased, and so did his hypochondria. For a number of years he had complained of all sorts of abdominal symptoms, though his doctor had been unable to find anything definite wrong with him. Now he complained of the sensation of having stones in the abdomen. For a long time we did not take this seriously. But at last the doctor became suspicious. Soon afterward his condition deteriorated. In late autumn of 1895 he became bedridden, and early in 1896 he died. I had come home after lectures and asked how he was. "Oh, still the same. He's very weak," my mother said. He whispered something to her, which she repeated to me, warning me with her eyes of his delirious condition. "He wants to know whether you have passed the state examination." I saw that I must lie. "Yes, it went very well." He sighed with relief and closed his eyes. A little later I went in to see him again. He was alone. My mother was doing something in the adjoining room. There was a rattling in his throat, and I could see that he was in the death agony. I stood by his bed, fascinated. I had never seen anyone die before. Suddenly, he stopped breathing. I waited, and waited for the next breath. It did not come. Then I remembered my mother, and went into the next room, where she sat by the window, knitting. "He is dying," I said. She came with me to the bed, and saw that he was dead. She said, as if in wonderment, "How quickly it has all passed." The following days were gloomy and painful, and little of them has remained in my memory. Once my mother spoke to me, or to the surrounding air, and remarked, "He died in time for you," which appeared to mean, "You did not understand each other, and he might have become a hindrance to you." The words, "for you," hit me terribly hard, and I felt that a bit of the old days had come irrevocably to an end. At the same time, a bit of manliness and freedom awoke in me. After my father's death, I moved into his room and took his place inside the family. For instance, I had to hand out the housekeeping money to my mother every week, because she was unable to economize and could not manage money. 6 weeks after his death, my father appeared to me in a dream. Suddenly he stood before me and said that he was coming back from his holiday. He had made a good recovery and was now coming home. I thought he would be annoyed with me for having moved into his room, but not a bit of it. Nevertheless, I felt ashamed because I had imagined he was dead. 2 days later, the dream was repeated. Later, I kept asking myself, what does it mean that my father returns in dreams, that he seems so real? It was an unforgettable experience, and it forced me for the first time to think about life after death. In 1898, I began to think more seriously about my career as a medical man. I soon came to the conclusion that I would have to specialize. The choice seemed to lie between surgery and internal medicine. Though I had attended psychiatric lectures and clinics, the current instructor in psychiatry was not exactly stimulating, and this was not calculated to prepossess me in favor of psychiatry. In preparing myself for the state examination, therefore, the textbook on psychiatry by Krafft-Ebing was the last I attacked. I expected nothing of it, and I still remember that as I opened the book, the thought came to me, well, now let's see what a psychiatrist has to say for himself. By way of excuse for this high and mighty attitude, I must make it clear that in the medical world at that time, psychiatry was quite generally held in contempt. No one really knew anything about it, and there was no psychology which regarded man as a whole and included his pathological variations in the total picture. The director was locked up in the same institution with his patients, and the institution was equally cut off, isolated on the outskirts of the city like an ancient lazaret with its lepers. Beginning with the preface, I read, "It is probably due to the peculiarity of the subject and its incomplete state of development that psychiatric textbooks are stamped with a more or less subjective character. A few lines further on, the author called the psychoses diseases of the personality. My heart suddenly began to pound. I had to stand up and draw a deep breath. My excitement was intense, for it had become clear to me, in a flash of illumination, that for me the only possible goal was psychiatry. Here alone the two currents of my interest could flow together, and in a united stream dig their own bed. Here was the empirical field common to biological and spiritual facts, which I had everywhere sought and nowhere found. Here at last was the place where the collision of nature and spirit became a reality. My violent reaction set in when Krafft Ebing spoke of the subjective character of psychiatric textbooks. So I thought, the textbook is in part the subjective confession of the author. With his specific prejudice, with the totality of his being, he stands behind the objectivity of his experiences and responds to the disease of the personality with the whole of his own personality. The decision was taken. When I informed my teacher in internal medicine of my intention, I could read in his face his amazement and disappointment. My old wound, the feeling of being an outsider and of alienating others, began to ache again. But now I understood why. No one, not even myself, had ever imagined I could become interested in this obscure bypath. My friends were astounded and put out, thinking me a fool for throwing up the enviable chance of a sensible career in internal medicine, which dangled so temptingly before my nose, in favor of this psychiatric nonsense. On December 10th, 1900, I took up my post as assistant at Berghölzli Mental Hospital, Zurich. When I came to that city, I felt the difference at once. Zurich relates to the world not by the intellect, but by commerce. Yet here the air was free, and I had always valued that. Here you were not weighed down by the brown fog of the centuries, even though one missed the rich background of culture. Psychiatric activities. The years at Berghölzli were my years of apprenticeship. Dominating my interests and research was the burning question, what actually takes place inside the mentally ill? That was something which I did not understand then, nor had any of my colleagues concerned themselves with such problems. Patients were labeled, rubber-stamped with a diagnosis, and for the most part, that settled the matter. At this point, Freud's work became vitally important to me, especially because of his fundamental researches into the psychology of hysteria and of dreams. For me, his ideas pointed the way to a closer investigation and understanding of individual cases. Freud introduced psychology into psychiatry, although he himself was a neurologist. I still recollect very well a case which greatly interested me at the time. A young woman had been admitted to the hospital suffering from melancholia. The examination was conducted with the usual care, case histories, tests, physical checkups, and so on. The diagnosis was schizophrenia, or dementia praecox, in the phrase of those days. The prognosis, poor. This woman happened to be in my section. At first, I did not dare to question the diagnosis. I was still a young man then, a beginner, and yet the case struck me as strange. I had the feeling that it was not a matter of schizophrenia, but of ordinary depression, and resolved to apply my own method. At the time, I was much occupied with diagnostic association studies, and so I undertook an association experiment with the patient. In addition, I discussed her dreams with her. In this way, I succeeded in uncovering her past, which the case history had not clarified. I obtained information directly from the unconscious, and this information revealed a dark and tragic story. Before the woman married, she had known a man, the son of a wealthy industrialist, in whom all the girls of the neighborhood were interested. Since she was very pretty, she thought her chances of catching him were fairly good. But apparently he did not care for her, and so she married another man. 5 years later, an old friend visited her. They were talking over old times, and he said to her, "When you got married, it was quite a shock to someone. Your Mr. X, the wealthy industrialist's son." That was the moment. Her depression dated from this period, and several weeks later led to a catastrophe. She was bathing her children, first her 4-year-old girl, and then her 2-year-old son. She lived in a country where the water supply was not perfectly hygienic. There was pure spring water for drinking, and tainted water from the river for bathing and washing. While she was bathing the little girl, she saw the child sucking at the sponge, but did not stop her. She even gave her little son a glass of the impure water to drink. Naturally, she did this unconsciously, or only half-consciously, for her mind was already under the shadow of the incipient depression. A short time later, after the incubation period had passed, the girl came down with typhoid fever and died. The girl had been her favorite. The boy was not infected. At that moment, the depression reached its acute stage, and the woman was sent to the institution. From the association test, I had seen that she was a murderess, and I had learned many of the details of her secret. It was at once apparent that this was a sufficient reason for her depression. Essentially, it was a psychogenic disturbance and not a case of schizophrenia. Now, what could be done in the way of therapy? Up to then, the woman had been given narcotics to combat her insomnia and had been under guard to prevent attempts at suicide. But otherwise, nothing had been done. Physically, she was in good condition. I was confronted with the problem. Should I speak openly with her or not? If I had asked my colleagues, they would probably have warned me, "For heaven's sake, don't tell the woman any such thing. That will only make her still crazier." Of course, I knew very well the personal risk I was running. If the patient got worse, I would be in the soup too. Nevertheless, I decided to take a chance on a therapy whose outcome was uncertain. I told her everything I had discovered through the association test. It can easily be imagined how difficult it was for me to do this. To accuse a person point-blank of murder is no small matter, and it was tragic for the patient to have to listen to it and accept it. But the result was that in 2 weeks it proved possible to discharge her, and she was never again institutionalized. There were other reasons that caused me to say nothing to my colleagues about this case. I was afraid of their discussing and possibly raising legal questions. Fate had punished her enough. It seemed to me more meaningful that she should return to life in order to atone in life for her crime. When she was discharged, she departed bearing her heavy burden. She had to bear this burden. The loss of the child had been frightful for her, and her expiation had already begun with the depression and her confinement to the institution. In many cases in psychiatry, the patient who comes to us has a story that is not told, and which, as a rule, no one knows of. To my mind, therapy only really begins after the investigation of the wholly personal story. It is the patient's secret, the rock against which he is shattered. If I know his secret story, I have a key to the treatment. The doctor's task is to find out how to gain that knowledge. In most cases, exploration of the conscious material is insufficient. Sometimes an association test can open the way. So can the interpretation of dreams, or long and patient human contact with the individual. In therapy, the problem is always the whole person, never the symptom alone. We must ask questions which challenge the whole personality. In my practice, I was constantly impressed by the way the human psyche reacts to a crime committed unconsciously. After all, that young woman was initially not aware that she had killed her child, and yet she had fallen into a condition that appeared to be the expression of extreme consciousness of guilt. I once had a similar case which I have never forgotten. A lady came into my office. She refused to give her name, said it did not matter, since she wished to have only the one consultation. It was apparent that she belonged to the upper levels of society. She had been a doctor, she said. What she had to communicate to me was a confession. Some 20 years ago, she had committed a murder out of jealousy. She had poisoned her best friend because she wanted to marry the friend's husband. She had thought that if the murder was not discovered, it would not disturb her. Moral considerations were of no importance to her, she thought. The consequences? She had in fact married the man, but he had died soon afterward, relatively young. During the following years, a number of strange things happened. The daughter of this marriage endeavored to get away from her as soon as she was grown up. She married young and vanished from view, drew further and further away, and ultimately the mother lost all contact with her. This lady was a passionate horsewoman, and owned several riding horses, of which she was extremely fond. One day she discovered that the horses were beginning to grow nervous under her. Even her favorite shied and threw her. Finally she had to give up riding. Thereafter she clung to her dogs. She owned an unusually beautiful wolfhound, to which she was greatly attached. As chance would have it, this very dog was stricken with paralysis. With that, her cup was full. She felt that she was morally done for. She had to confess, and for this purpose she came to me. She was a murderess, but on top of that, she had also murdered herself. For one who commits such a crime destroys his own soul. The murderer has already passed sentence on himself. If someone has committed a crime and is caught, he suffers judicial punishment. If he has done it secretly, without moral consciousness of it, and remains undiscovered, the punishment can nevertheless be visited upon him, as our case shows. As a result of the murder, the woman was plunged into unbearable loneliness. And in order to shake off this loneliness, she had made me share her knowledge. She had to have someone who was not a murderer to share the secret. She wanted to find a person who could accept her confession without prejudice, for by so doing, she would achieve once more something resembling a relationship to humanity. She had seen people and animals turn away from her, and had been so struck by this silent verdict that she could not have endured further condemnation. I never found out who she was, nor do I have any proof that her story was true. Sometimes I have to ask myself what might have become of her, for that was by no means the end of her journey. Perhaps she was driven ultimately to suicide. I cannot imagine how she could have gone on living in that utter loneliness. Clinical diagnoses are important, since they give the doctor a certain orientation, but they do not help the patient. The crucial thing is the story, for it alone shows the human background and the human suffering, and only at that point can the doctor's therapy begin to operate. Through my work with the patients, I realized that paranoid ideas and hallucinations contain a germ of meaning. A personality, a life history, a pattern of hopes and desires lie behind the psychosis. The fault is ours, if we do not understand them. It dawned upon me then for the first time that a general psychology of the personality lies concealed within the psychosis, and that even here we come upon the old human conflicts. Although patients may appear dull and apathetic or totally imbecilic, there is more going on in their minds, and more that is meaningful than there seems to be. At bottom, we discover nothing new and unknown in the mentally ill. Rather, we encounter the substratum of our own natures. Regarding them from the outside, all we see of the mentally ill is their tragic destruction. Rarely the life of that side of the psyche which is turned away from us. Outward appearances are frequently deceptive, as I discovered to my astonishment in the case of a young catatonic patient. She was 18 years old and came from a cultivated family. At the age of 15, she had been seduced by her brother and abused by a schoolmate. From her 16th year on, she retreated into isolation. She concealed herself from people, and ultimately the only emotional relationship left to her was one with a vicious watchdog which belonged to another family, and which she tried to win over. She grew steadily odder, and at 17 was taken to the mental hospital, where she spent a year and a half. She heard voices, refused food, and was completely mutistic. When I first saw her, she was in a typical catatonic state. In the course of many weeks, I succeeded, very gradually, in persuading her to speak. After overcoming many resistances, she told me that she had lived on the moon. The moon, it seemed, was inhabited, but at first she had seen only men. They had once taken her with them and deposited her in a sublunar dwelling where their children and wives were kept. For on a high mountain on the moon there lived a vampire who kidnapped and killed the women and children, so that the moon people were threatened with extinction. That was the reason for the sublunar existence of the feminine half of the population. My patient made up her mind to do something for the moon people and planned to destroy the vampire. After long preparations, she waited for the vampire on the platform of a tower which had been erected for this purpose. After a number of nights, she saw the monster approaching from afar, winging his way toward her like a great black bird. She took her long sacrificial knife, concealed it in her gown, and waited for the vampire's arrival. Suddenly, he stood before her. He had several pairs of wings. His face and entire figure were covered by them, so that she could see nothing but his feathers. Wonderstruck, she was seized by curiosity to find out what he really looked like. She approached, hand on the knife. Suddenly the wings opened, and a man of unearthly beauty stood before her. He enclosed her in his winged arms with an iron grip, so that she could no longer wield the knife. In any case, she was so spellbound by the vampire's look that she would not have been capable of striking. He raised her from the platform and flew off with her. After this revelation, she was once again able to speak without inhibition, and now her resistances emerged. It seemed that I had stopped her return to the moon. She could no longer escape from the earth. This world was not beautiful, she said, but the moon was beautiful, and life there was rich in meaning. Sometime later, she suffered a relapse into her catatonia, and I had to have her taken to a sanatorium. For a while, she was violently insane. When she was discharged after some 2 months, it was once again possible to talk with her. Gradually, she came to see that life on Earth was unavoidable. Desperately, she fought against this conclusion and its consequences, and had to be sent back to the sanatorium. Once I visited her in her cell and said to her, "All this won't do you any good. You cannot return to the moon." She took this in silence, and with an appearance of utter apathy. This time, she was released after a short stay and resigned herself to her fate. For a while, she took a job as a nurse in a sanatorium. There was an assistant doctor there who made a somewhat rash approach to her. She responded with a revolver shot. Luckily, the man was only slightly wounded, but the incident revealed that she went about with a revolver all the time. Once before, she had turned up with a loaded gun. During the last interview, at the end of the treatment, she gave it to me. When I asked in amazement what she was doing with it, she replied, "I would have shot you down if you had failed me." When the excitement over the shooting had subsided, she returned to her native town. She married, had several children, and survived 2 world wars in the East without ever again suffering a relapse. What can be said by way of interpretation of these fantasies? As a result of the incest to which she had been subjected as a girl, she felt humiliated in the eyes of the world, but elevated in the realm of fantasy. She had been transported into a mythic realm, for incest is traditionally a prerogative of royalty and divinities. The consequence was complete alienation from the world, a state of psychosis. She became extra mundane, as it were, and lost contact with humanity. She plunged into cosmic distances, into outer space, where she met with the winged demon. As is the rule with such things, she projected his figure onto me during the treatment. Thus I was automatically threatened with death, as was everyone who might have persuaded her to return to normal human life. By telling me her story, she had in a sense betrayed the demon and attached herself to an earthly human being. Hence she was able to return to life, and even to marry. Thereafter, I regarded the sufferings of the mentally ill in a different light, for I had gained insight into the richness and importance of their inner experience. I'm often asked about my psychotherapeutic or analytic method. I cannot reply unequivocally to the question. Therapy is different in every case. When a doctor tells me that he adheres strictly to this or that method, I have my doubts about his therapeutic effect. So much is said in the literature about the resistance of the patient that it would almost seem as if the doctor were trying to put something over on him, whereas the cure ought to grow naturally out of the patient himself. Psychotherapy and analysis are as varied as our human individuals. I treat every patient as individually as possible, because the solution of the problem is always an individual one. Universal rules can be postulated only with a grain of salt. A psychological truth is valid only if it can be reversed. A solution which would be out of the question for me may be just the right one for someone else. Naturally, a doctor must be familiar with the so-called methods, but he must guard against falling into any specific routine assumptions. In my analyses, they play no part. I am unsystematic very much by intention. To my mind, in dealing with individuals, only individual understanding will do. We need a different language for every patient. The crucial point is that I confront the patient as one human being to another. Analysis is a dialogue demanding two partners. Analyst and patient sit facing one another, eye to eye. The doctor has something to say, but so has the patient. Since the essence of psychotherapy is not the application of a method, psychiatric study alone does not suffice. I myself had to work for a long time before I possessed the equipment for psychotherapy. As early as 1909, I realized that I could not treat latent psychoses if I did not understand their symbolism. It was then I began to study mythology. As a doctor, I constantly have to ask myself what kind of message the patient is bringing me. What does he mean to me? If he means nothing, I have no point of attack. The doctor is effective only when he himself is affected. Only the wounded physician heals. It often happens that the patient is exactly the right plaster for the doctor's sore spot. I have frequently seen people become neurotic when they content themselves with inadequate or wrong answers to the questions of life. They seek position, marriage, reputation, outward success or money, and remain unhappy and neurotic even when they have attained what they were seeking. Such people are usually confined within too narrow a spiritual horizon. Their life has not sufficient content, sufficient meaning. If they are enabled to develop into more spacious personalities, the neurosis generally disappears. For that reason, the idea of development was always of the highest importance to me. The majority of my patients consisted not of believers, but of those who had lost their faith. The ones who came to me were the lost sheep. Even in this day and age, the believer has the opportunity in his church to live the symbolic life. We need only think of the experience of the Mass, of baptism, of the imitation of Christ, and many other aspects of religion. But to live and experience symbols presupposes a vital participation on the part of the believer, and only too often this is lacking in people today. In the neurotic, it is practically always lacking. In such cases, we have to observe whether the unconscious will not spontaneously bring up symbols to replace what is lacking. But then the question remains of whether a person who has symbolic dreams or visions will also be able to understand their meaning and take the consequences upon himself. Wherever there is a reaching down into innermost experience, into the nucleus of personality, most people are overcome by fright, and many run away. The risk of inner experience, the adventure of the spirit, is in any case alien to most human beings. The possibility that such experience might have a psychic reality is anathema to them. All very well if it has a supernatural, or at least a historical foundation. But psychic? Face to face with this question, the patient will often show an unsuspected but profound contempt for the psyche. Among the so-called neurotics of our day, there are a good many who in other ages would not have been neurotic, that is, divided against themselves. If they had lived in a period and a milieu in which man was still linked by myth with the world of the ancestors, and thus with nature truly experienced and not merely seen from outside, they would have been spared this division with themselves. These victims of the psychic dichotomy of our time are merely optional neurotics. Their apparent morbidity drops away the moment the gulf between the ego and the unconscious is closed. The doctor who has felt this dichotomy to the depths of his being will also be able to reach a better understanding of the unconscious psychic processes and will be saved from the danger of inflation to which the psychologist is prone. The doctor who does not know from his own experience the numinosity of the archetypes will scarcely be able to escape their negative effect when he encounters it in his practice. He will tend to over- or underestimate it, since he possesses only an intellectual point of view, but no empirical criterion. This is where those perilous aberrations begin, the first of which is the attempt to dominate everything by the intellect. This serves the secret purpose of placing both doctor and patient at a safe distance from the archetypal effect, and thus from real experience, and of substituting for psychic reality an apparently secure, artificial, but merely two-dimensional conceptual world in which the reality of life is well covered up by so-called clear concepts. Experience is stripped of its substance, and instead mere names are substituted, which are henceforth put in place of reality. No one has any obligations to a concept. That is what is so agreeable about conceptuality. It promises protection from experience. The spirit does not dwell in concepts, but in deeds and in facts. Words butter no parsnips. Nevertheless, this futile procedure is repeated ad infinitum. In my experience, therefore, the most difficult, as well as the most ungrateful patients, apart from habitual liars, are the so-called intellectuals. With them, one hand never knows what the other hand is doing. They cultivate a compartment psychology. Anything can be settled by an intellect that is not subject to the control of feeling, and yet the intellectual still suffers from a neurosis if feeling is undeveloped. From my encounters with patients and with psychic phenomena, which they have paraded before me in an endless stream of images, I have learned an enormous amount, not just knowledge, but above all, insight into my own nature. And not the least of what I have learned has come from my errors and defeats. I have had mainly women patients, who often entered into the work with extraordinary conscientiousness, understanding, and intelligence. It was essentially because of them that I was able to strike out on new paths in therapy. A number of my patients became my disciples and have carried my ideas out into the world. Among them, I have made friendships that have endured decade after decade. My patients brought me so close to the reality of human life that I could not help learning essential things from them. Encounters with people of so many different kinds and on so many different levels have been for me incomparably more important than fragmentary conversations with celebrities. The finest and most significant conversations of my life were anonymous. Sigmund Freud. I embarked on the adventure of my intellectual development by becoming a psychiatrist. As early as 1900, I had read Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams. I had laid the book aside at the time, because I did not yet grasp it. At the age of 25, I lacked the experience to appreciate Freud's theories. Such experience did not come until later. In 1903, I once more took up The Interpretation of Dreams, and discovered how it all linked up with my own ideas. What chiefly interested me was the application to dreams of the concept of the repression mechanism, which was derived from the psychology of neuroses. This was important to me because I had frequently encountered repressions in my experiments with word association. In response to certain stimulus words, the patient either had no associative answer or was unduly slow in his reaction time. As was later discovered, such a disturbance occurred each time the stimulus word had touched upon a psychic lesion or conflict. In most cases, the patient was unconscious of this. When questioned about the cause of the disturbance, he would often answer in a peculiarly artificial manner. My reading of Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams showed me that the repression mechanism was at work here, and that the facts I had observed were consonant with his theory. Thus I was able to corroborate Freud's line of argument. The situation was different when it came to the content of the repression. Here, I could not agree with Freud. He considered the cause of the repression to be a sexual trauma. From my practice, however, I was familiar with numerous cases of neurosis in which the question of sexuality played a subordinate part, other factors standing in the foreground. For example, the problem of social adaptation, of oppression by tragic circumstances of life, prestige considerations, and so on. Later, I presented such cases to Freud, but he would not grant that factors other than sexuality could be the cause. That was highly unsatisfactory to me. At the beginning, it was not easy for me to assign Freud the proper place in my life, or to take the right attitude toward him. When I became acquainted with his work, I was planning an academic career and was about to complete a paper that was intended to advance me at the university. But Freud was definitely persona non grata in the academic world at the time, and any connection with him would have been damaging in scientific circles. Important people at most mentioned him surreptitiously, and at congresses he was discussed only in the corridors, never on the floor. Therefore, the discovery that my association experiments were in agreement with Freud's theories was far from pleasant to me. Once, while I was in my laboratory and reflecting again upon these questions, the devil whispered to me that I would be justified in publishing the results of my experiments and my conclusions without mentioning Freud. But then I heard the voice of my second personality. You cannot build your life upon a lie. With that, the question was settled. From then on, I became an open partisan of Freud's and fought for him. I first took up the cudgels for Freud at a congress in Munich, where a lecturer discussed obsessional neuroses, but studiously forbore to mention the name of Freud. In 1906, in connection with this incident, I wrote a paper on Freud's theory of the neurosis, which had contributed a great deal to the understanding of obsessional neuroses. In response to this article, two German professors wrote to me, warning that if I remained on Freud's side and continued to defend him, I would be endangering my academic career. I replied, "If what Freud says is the truth, I am with him. I don't give a damn for a career if it has to be based on the premise of restricting research and concealing truth." And I went on defending Freud and his ideas. But on the basis of my own findings, I was still unable to feel that all neuroses were caused by sexual repression or sexual trauma. In certain cases that was so, but not in others. Nevertheless, Freud had opened up a new path of investigation, and the shocked outcries against him at the time seemed to me absurd. I had not met with much sympathy for the ideas expressed in The Psychology of Dementia Praecox. In fact, my colleagues laughed at me. But through this book, I came to know Freud. He invited me to visit him, and our first meeting took place in Vienna in March 1907. We met at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and talked virtually without a pause for 13 hours. Freud was the first man of real importance I had encountered. In my experience up to that time, no one else could compare with him. There was nothing the least trivial in his attitude. I found him extremely intelligent, shrewd, and altogether remarkable. And yet my first impressions of him remained somewhat tangled. I could not make him out. Above all, Freud's attitude toward the spirit seemed to me highly questionable. Wherever, in a person or in a work of art, an expression of spirituality came to light, he suspected it, and insinuated that it was repressed sexuality. Anything that could not be directly interpreted as sexuality, he referred to as psychosexuality. I protested that this hypothesis, carried to its logical conclusion, would lead to an annihilating judgment upon culture. Culture would then appear as a mere farce, the morbid consequence of repressed sexuality. Yes, he assented, so it is. And that is just a curse of fate against which we are powerless to contend. I was by no means disposed to agree, or to let it go at that, but still I did not feel competent to argue it out with him. I can still recall vividly how Freud said to me, "My dear Jung, promise me never to abandon the sexual theory. That is the most essential thing of all. You see, we must make a dogma of it, an unshakable bulwark." He said that to me with great emotion, in the tone of a father saying, "And promise me this one thing, my dear son, that you will go to church every Sunday." In some astonishment, I asked him, "A bulwark? Against what?" To which he replied, "Against the black tide of mud." And here he hesitated a moment, then added, "Of occultism." First of all, it was the words bulwark and dogma that alarmed me. For a dogma, that is to say, an undisputable confession of faith, is set up only when the aim is to suppress doubts once and for all. But that no longer has anything to do with scientific judgment, only with a personal power drive. This was the thing that struck at the heart of our friendship. I knew I would never be able to accept such an attitude. Although I did not properly understand it then, I had observed in Freud the eruption of unconscious religious factors. Evidently, he wanted my aid in erecting a barrier against these threatening unconscious contents. I was bewildered and embarrassed. I had the feeling that I had caught a glimpse of a new, unknown country from which swarms of new ideas flew to meet me. One thing was clear. Freud, who had always made much of his irreligiosity, had now constructed a dogma. Or rather, in the place of a jealous god whom he had lost, he had substituted another compelling image, that of sexuality. It was no less insistent, exacting, domineering, threatening, and morally ambivalent than the original one. Just as the psychically stronger agency is given divine or demonic attributes, so the sexual libido took over the role of a hidden or concealed god. The advantage of this transformation for Freud was, apparently, that he was able to regard the new numinous principle as scientifically irreproachable and free from all religious taint. At bottom, however, the numinosity, that is, the psychological qualities of the two rationally incommensurable opposites, Yahweh and sexuality, remained the same. The name alone had changed, and with it, of course, the point of view. The lost god had now to be sought below, not above. Like flames suddenly flaring up, these thoughts darted through my mind. Much later, when I reflected upon Freud's character, they revealed their significance. There was one characteristic of his that preoccupied me above all, his bitterness. Freud never asked himself why he was compelled to talk continually of sex, why this idea had taken such possession of him. He remained unaware that his monotony of interpretation expressed a flight from himself, or from that other side of him which might perhaps be called mystical. So long as he refused to acknowledge that side, he could never be reconciled with himself. He was blind toward the paradox and ambiguity of the contents of the unconscious, and did not know that everything which arises out of the unconscious has a top and a bottom, an inside and an outside. When we speak of the outside, and that is what Freud did, we are considering only half of the whole, with the result that a counter-effect arises out of the unconscious. There was nothing to be done about this one-sidedness of Freud's. Perhaps some inner experience of his own might have opened his eyes, but then his intellect would have reduced such experience to mere sexuality or psychosexuality. He remained the victim of the one aspect he could recognize, and for that reason I see him as a tragic figure, for he was a great man, and what is more, a man in the grip of his diamond. The year 1909 proved decisive for our relationship. I had been invited to lecture on the association experiment at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Independently, Freud had also received an invitation, and we decided to travel together. We met in Bremen, where Ferenczi joined us. In Bremen, the much-discussed incident of Freud's fainting fit occurred. It was provoked, indirectly, by my interest in the peat bog corpses. I knew that in certain districts of northern Germany, these so-called bog corpses were to be found. They are the bodies of prehistoric men who either drowned in the marshes or were buried there. The bog water in which the bodies lie contains humic acid, which consumes the bones and simultaneously tans the skin, so that it and the hair are perfectly preserved. In essence, this is the process of natural mummification. This interest of mine got on Freud's nerves. "Why are you so concerned with these corpses?" he asked me several times. He was inordinately vexed by the whole thing, and during one such conversation, while we were having dinner together, he suddenly fainted. Afterward, he said to me that he was convinced that all this chatter about corpses meant I had death wishes toward him. I was more than surprised by this interpretation. I was alarmed by the intensity of his fantasies, so strong that obviously they could cause him to faint. In a similar connection, Freud once more suffered a fainting fit in my presence. This was during the Psychoanalytic Congress in Munich in 1912. Someone had turned the conversation to the Egyptian king Akhenaten. The point was made that, as a result of his negative attitude toward his father, he had destroyed his father's cartouches on the steles, and that at the back of his great creation of monotheistic religion there lurked a father complex. At that moment, Freud slid off his chair in a faint. Everyone clustered helplessly around him. I picked him up, carried him into the next room, and laid him on a sofa. As I was carrying him, he half came to, and I shall never forget the look he cast at me. In his weakness, he looked at me as if I were his father. Whatever other causes may have contributed to this faint, the atmosphere was very tense. The fantasy of father murder was common to both cases. At the time, Freud frequently made allusions indicating that he regarded me as his successor. These hints were embarrassing to me. In the first place, that sort of thing was not in my nature. In the second place, I could not sacrifice my intellectual independence. And in the third place, such luster was highly unwelcome to me, since it would only deflect from my real aims. I was concerned with investigating truth, not with questions of personal prestige. The trip to the United States, which began in Bremen in 1909, lasted for 7 weeks. We were together every day and analyzed each other's dreams. I regarded Freud as an older, more mature, and experienced personality, and felt like a son in that respect. But then something happened which proved to be a severe blow to the whole relationship. Freud had a dream. I would not think it right to air the problem it involved. I interpreted it as best I could, but added that a great deal more could be said about it if he would supply me with some additional details from his private life. Freud's response to these words was a curious look, a look of the utmost suspicion. Then he said, "But I cannot risk my authority." At that moment he lost it altogether. That sentence burned itself into my memory, and in it the end of our relationship was already foreshadowed. Freud was placing personal authority over truth. Freud was able to interpret the dreams I was then having only incompletely, or not at all. One in particular was important to me, for it led me for the first time to the concept of the collective unconscious, and thus formed a kind of prelude to my book Symbols of Transformation. This was the dream. I was in a house I did not know, which had two stories. It was my house. I found myself in the upper story, where there was a kind of salon furnished with fine old pieces in Rococo style. Descending the stairs, I reached the ground floor. There, everything was much older, and I realized that this part of the house must date from about the 15th or 16th century. The furnishings were medieval. I came upon a heavy door and opened it. Beyond it, I discovered a stone stairway that led down into the cellar. Descending again, I found myself in a beautifully vaulted room, which looked exceedingly ancient. I discovered layers of brick among the ordinary stone blocks, and chips of brick in the mortar. As soon as I saw this, I knew that the walls dated from Roman times. My interest by now was intense. I looked more closely at the floor. It was of stone slabs, and in one of these I discovered a ring. When I pulled it, the stone slab lifted, and again I saw a stairway of narrow stone steps leading down into the depths. These two I descended, and entered a low cave cut into the rock. Thick dust lay on the floor, and in the dust were scattered bones and broken pottery, like remains of a primitive culture. I discovered two human skulls, obviously very old and half disintegrated. Then I awoke. What chiefly interested Freud in this dream were the two skulls. He returned to them repeatedly and urged me to find a wish in connection with them. What did I think about these skulls, and whose were they? I knew perfectly well, of course, what he was driving at, that secret death wishes were concealed in the dream. But what does he really expect of me, I thought to myself. Toward whom would I have death wishes? I felt violent resistance to any such interpretation. I also had some intimation of what the dream might really mean, but I did not then trust my own judgment, and wanted to hear Freud's opinion. I wanted to learn from him. Therefore I submitted to his intention and said, "My wife and sister-in-law." And so I told him a lie. It was plain to me that the house represented a kind of image of the psyche, that is to say, of my then state of consciousness, with hitherto unconscious additions. Consciousness was represented by the salon. It had an inhabited atmosphere, in spite of its antiquated style. The ground floor stood for the first level of the unconscious. The deeper I went, the more alien and the darker the scene became. In the cave, I discovered remains of a primitive culture, that is, the world of the primitive man within myself, a world which can scarcely be reached or illuminated by consciousness. The primitive psyche of man borders on the life of the animal soul, just as the caves of prehistoric times were usually inhabited by animals before men laid claim to them. Certain questions had been much on my mind during the days preceding this dream. On what premises is Freudian psychology founded? To what category of human thought does it belong? What is the relationship of its almost exclusive personalism to general historical assumptions? My dream was giving me the answer. It obviously pointed to the foundations of cultural history, a history of successive layers of consciousness. My dream thus constituted a kind of structural diagram of the human psyche. It postulated something of an altogether impersonal nature underlying that psyche. It clicked, as the English have it, and the dream became for me a guiding image which in the days to come was to be corroborated to an extent I could not at first suspect. It was my first inkling of a collective a priori beneath the personal psyche. This I first took to be the traces of earlier modes of functioning. Later, with increasing experience, and on the basis of more reliable knowledge, I recognized them as forms of instinct, that is, as archetypes. The dream of the house had a curious effect upon me. It revived my old interest in archaeology. I read like mad, and worked with feverish interest through a mountain of mythological material, then through the Gnostic writers, and ended in total confusion. It was as if I were in an imaginary madhouse, and were beginning to treat and analyze all the centaurs, nymphs, gods and goddesses, as though they were my patients. While thus occupied, I could not help but discover the close relationship between ancient mythology and the psychology of primitive people, and this led me to an intensive study of the latter. Under the impress of Freud's personality, I had, as far as possible, cast aside my own judgments and repressed my criticisms. That was the prerequisite for collaborating with him. But to me it was a profound disappointment that all the efforts of the probing mind had apparently succeeded in finding nothing more in the depths of the psyche than the all-too-familiar and all-too-human limitations. I had grown up in the country, among peasants, and what I was unable to learn in the stables, I found out from the Rabelaisian wit and untrammeled fantasies of our peasant folklore. Incest and perversions were not remarkable novelties to me, and did not call for any special explanation. Along with criminality, they formed part of the black lees that spoiled the taste of life by showing me only too plainly the ugliness and meaninglessness of human existence. That cabbages thrive in dung was something I had always taken for granted. In all honesty, I could discover no helpful insight in such knowledge. It's just that all of those people are city folks who know nothing about nature and the human stable, I thought, sick and tired of these ugly matters. One form of life cannot simply be abandoned unless it is exchanged for another. As for a totally rational approach to life, that is, as experience shows, impossible, especially when a person is by nature as unreasonable as a neurotic. I now realized why Freud's personal psychology was of such burning interest to me. I was eager to know the truth about his reasonable solution, and I was prepared to sacrifice a good deal in order to obtain the answer. Now I felt that I was on the track of it. Freud himself had a neurosis, no doubt diagnosable, and one with highly troublesome symptoms, as I discovered on our voyage to America. Of course, he had taught me that everybody is somewhat neurotic, and that we must practice tolerance. But I was not at all inclined to content myself with that. Rather, I wanted to know how one could escape having a neurosis. Apparently, neither Freud nor his disciples could understand what it meant for the theory and practice of psychoanalysis if not even the master could deal with his own neurosis. When, therefore, Freud announced his intention of identifying theory and method and making them into some kind of dogma, I could no longer collaborate with him. There remained no choice for me but to withdraw. When I was working on my book about the libido and approaching the end of the chapter, The Sacrifice, I knew in advance that its publication would cost me my friendship with Freud, for I planned to set down in it my own conception of incest, the decisive transformation of the concept of libido, and various other ideas in which I differed from Freud. To me, incest signified a personal complication only in the rarest cases. Usually, incest has a highly religious aspect, for which reason the incest theme plays a decisive part in almost all cosmogonies and in numerous myths. But Freud clung to the literal interpretation of it and could not grasp the spiritual significance of incest as a symbol. I knew that he would never be able to accept any of my ideas on this subject. Should I keep my thoughts to myself, or should I risk the loss of so important a friendship? At last, I resolved to go ahead with the writing, and it did indeed cost me Freud's friendship. After the break with Freud, all my friends and acquaintances dropped away. My book was declared to be rubbish. I was a mystic, and that settled the matter. But I had foreseen my isolation, and harbored no illusion about the reaction of my so-called friends. That was a point I had thoroughly considered beforehand. I had known that everything was at stake, that I had to take a stand for my convictions. I realized the chapter, The Sacrifice, meant my own sacrifice. Having reached this insight, I was able to write again, even though I knew that my ideas would go uncomprehended. In retrospect, I can say that I alone logically pursued two problems which most interested Freud: the problem of archaic vestiges and that of sexuality. It is a widespread error to imagine that I do not see the value of sexuality. On the contrary, it plays a large part in my psychology as an essential, though not the sole, expression of psychic wholeness. But my main concern had been to investigate, over and above its personal significance and biological function, its spiritual aspect and its numinous meaning, and thus to explain what Freud was so fascinated by but was unable to grasp. Sexuality is of the greatest importance as the expression of the thonic spirit. That spirit is the other face of God, the dark side of the God image. The question of the thonic spirit has occupied me ever since I began to delve into the world of alchemy. Basically, this interest was awakened by that early conversation with Freud, when, mystified, I felt how deeply stirred he was by the phenomenon of sexuality. Freud's greatest achievement probably consisted in taking neurotic patients seriously and entering into their peculiar individual psychology. He had the courage to let the case material speak for itself, and in this way was able to penetrate into the real psychology of his patients. He saw with the patient's eyes, so to speak, and so reached a deeper understanding of mental illness than had hitherto been possible. In this respect, he was free of bias and courageous, and succeeded in overcoming a host of prejudices. Like an Old Testament prophet, he undertook to overthrow false gods, to rip the veils away from a mass of dishonesties and hypocrisies, mercilessly exposing the rottenness of the contemporary psyche. He did not falter in the face of the unpopularity such an enterprise entailed. The impetus which he gave our civilization sprang from his discovery of an avenue to the unconscious. By evaluating dreams as the most important source of information concerning the unconscious processes, he gave back to mankind a tool that had seemed irretrievably lost. He demonstrated empirically the presence of an unconscious psyche which had hitherto existed only as a philosophical postulate. Confrontation with the unconscious. After the parting of the ways with Freud, a period of inner uncertainty began for me. It would be no exaggeration to call it a state of disorientation. I felt totally suspended in midair, for I had not yet found my own footing. Above all, I felt it necessary to develop a new attitude toward my patients. I resolved for the present not to bring any theoretical premises to bear upon them, but to wait and see what they would tell of their own accord. My aim became to leave things to chance. The result was that the patients would spontaneously report their dreams and fantasies to me, and I would merely ask, "What occurs to you in connection with that?" or, "How do you mean that? Where does that come from? What do you think about it?" The interpretations seemed to follow of their own accord from the patient's replies and associations. I avoided all theoretical points of view and simply helped the patients to understand the dream images by themselves, without application of rules and theories. Soon I realized that it was right to take the dreams in this way as the basis of interpretation, for that is how dreams are intended. They are the facts from which we must proceed. About this time, I experienced a moment of unusual clarity, in which I looked back over the way I had traveled so far. I thought, Now you possess a key to mythology and are free to unlock all the gates of the unconscious psyche. But then something whispered within me, why open all the gates? And promptly the question arose of what, after all, I had accomplished. I had explained the myths of peoples of the past. I had written a book about the hero, the myth in which man had always lived. But in what myth does man live nowadays? In the Christian myth, the answer might be. Do you live in it? I asked myself. To be honest, the answer was no. For me, it is not what I live by. Then do we no longer have any myth? No, evidently we no longer have any myth. But then, what is your myth, the myth in which you live? At this point, the dialogue with myself became uncomfortable, and I stopped thinking. I had reached a dead end. From the beginning, I had conceived my voluntary confrontation with the unconscious as a scientific experiment which I myself was conducting, and in whose outcome I was vitally interested. Today, I might equally well say that it was an experiment which was conducted on me. One of the greatest difficulties for me lay in dealing with my negative feelings. I was voluntarily submitting myself to emotions of which I could not really approve, and I was writing down fantasies which often struck me as nonsense, and toward which I had strong resistances. For as long as we do not understand their meaning, such fantasies are a diabolical mixture of the sublime and the ridiculous. It cost me a great deal to undergo them, but I have been challenged by fate. Only by extreme effort was I finally able to escape from the labyrinth. It was during the advent of the year 1913 that I resolved upon the decisive step. I was sitting at my desk once more, thinking over my fears. Then I let them drop. Suddenly, it was as though the ground literally gave way beneath my feet, and I plunged down into dark depths. But then, abruptly, at not too great a depth, I landed on my feet in a soft, sticky mass. I felt great relief, although I was apparently in complete darkness. After a while, my eyes grew accustomed to the gloom. Before me was the entrance to a dark cave, in which stood a dwarf with a leathery skin, as if he were mummified. I squeezed past him through the narrow entrance and waded knee-deep through icy water to the other end of the cave, where on a projecting rock I saw a glowing red crystal. I grasped the stone, lifted it, and discovered a hollow underneath. At first I could make out nothing, but then I saw that there was running water. In it a corpse floated by, a youth with blonde hair and a wound in the head. He was followed by a gigantic black scarab, and then by a red newborn sun rising out of the depths of the water. Dazzled by the light, I wanted to replace the stone upon the opening, but then a fluid welled out. It was blood. A thick jet of it leapt up, and I felt nauseated. It seemed to me that the blood continued to spurt for an unendurably long time. At last, it ceased, and the vision came to an end. I was stunned by this vision. I realized, of course, that it was a hero and solar myth, a drama of death and renewal, the rebirth symbolized by the Egyptian scarab. At the end, the dawn of the new day should have followed, but instead came the intolerable outpouring of blood, an altogether abnormal phenomenon, so it seemed to me. 6 days later, I had the following dream. I was with an unknown brown-skinned man in a lonely rocky mountain landscape. It was before dawn. The eastern sky was already bright, and the stars were fading. Then I heard the horn of Siegfried, the German epic hero, sounding over the mountains, and I knew that we had to kill him. We were armed with rifles and lay in wait for him on a narrow path over the rocks. Then Siegfried appeared high up on the crest of the mountain in the first ray of the rising sun. On a chariot made of the bones of the dead, he drove at furious speed down the precipitous slope. When he turned a corner, We shot at him, and he plunged down, struck dead. Filled with disgust and remorse for having destroyed something so great and beautiful, I turned to flee, impelled by the fear that the murder might be discovered. But a tremendous downfall of rain began, and I knew that it would wipe out all traces of the dead. I had escaped the danger of discovery. Life could go on, but an unbearable feeling of guilt remained. When I awoke from the dream, I turned it over in my mind. You must understand the dream, and must do so at once. The inner urgency mounted, until the terrible moment when the voice said, "If you do not understand the dream, you must shoot yourself." In the drawer of my night table lay a loaded revolver, and I became frightened. Then I began pondering once again, and suddenly the meaning of the dream dawned on me. Siegfried, I thought, represents what the Germans want to achieve, heroically to impose their will, have their own way. I had wanted to do the same, but now that was no longer possible. The dream showed that the attitude no longer suited me. Therefore, it had to be killed. My heroic idealism had to be abandoned, for there are higher things than the ego's will, and to these one must bow. I began to understand that the goal of psychic development is the self. There is no linear evolution. There is only a circumambulation of the self. Some years later, in 1927, I obtained confirmation of my ideas about the center and the self by way of a dream. I found myself in a dirty, sooty city. It was night and winter and raining. I was in Liverpool. The various quarters of the city were arranged radically around the square. In the center was a round pool, and in the middle of it a small island. On it stood a single tree, a magnolia, in a shower of reddish blossoms. It was as though the tree stood in the sunlight and was at the same time the source of light. This dream represented my situation at the time. Everything was extremely unpleasant, black and opaque, just as I felt then, but I had a vision of unearthly beauty, and that was why I was able to live at all. Liverpool is the pool of life. The liver, according to an old view, is the seat of life. I saw that here the goal had been revealed. One could not go beyond the center. The center is the goal, and everything is directed toward that center. Through this dream, I understood that the self is the principle and archetype of orientation and meaning. Without such a vision, I might perhaps have lost my orientation and been compelled to abandon my undertaking. But here, the meaning had been made clear. When I parted from Freud, I knew that I was plunging into the unknown. Beyond Freud, after all, I knew nothing. But I had taken the step into darkness. When that happens, and then such a dream comes, one feels it as an act of grace. The years when I was pursuing my inner images were the most important in my life. In them, everything essential was decided. It was the prima materia for a lifetime's work. The work. As my life entered its second half, I was already embarked on the confrontation with the contents of the unconscious. My work on this was an extremely long drawn-out affair, and it was only after some 20 years of it that I reached some degree of understanding of my fantasies. First, I had to find evidence for the historical prefigurations of my inner experiences. That is to say, I had to ask myself, where have my particular premises already occurred in history? If I had not succeeded in finding such evidence, I would never have been able to substantiate my ideas. Therefore, my encounter with alchemy was decisive for me, as it provided me with the historical basis I had hitherto lacked. analytical psychology coincided in a most curious way with alchemy. The experiences of the alchemists were, in a sense, my experiences, and their world was my world. This was, of course, a momentous discovery. I had stumbled upon the historical counterpart of my psychology of the unconscious. The possibility of a comparison with alchemy and the uninterrupted intellectual chain back to Gnosticism gave substance to my psychology. When I pored over these old texts, everything fell into place. The fantasy images, the empirical material I had gathered in my practice, and the conclusions I had drawn from it. I now began to understand what these psychic contents meant when seen in historical perspective. My understanding of their typical character, which had already begun with my investigation of myths, were deepened. The primordial images and the nature of the archetype took a central place in my researches, and it became clear to me that without history, there can be no psychology, and certainly no psychology of the unconscious. I had a starting point in my intense preoccupation with the images of my own unconscious. This period lasted from 1913 to 1917. Then the stream of fantasies ebbed away. Not until it had subsided, and I was no longer held captive inside the magic mountain, was I able to take an objective view of that whole experience and begin to reflect upon it. The first question I asked myself was, what does one do with the unconscious? Only after I had familiarized myself with alchemy did I realize that the unconscious is a process, and that the psyche is transformed or developed by the relationship of the ego to the contents of the unconscious. In individual cases, that transformation can be read from dreams and fantasies. In collective life, it has left its deposit principally in the various religious systems and their changing symbols. Through the study of these collective transformation processes and through understanding of alchemical symbolism, I arrived at the central concept of my psychology, the process of individuation. An essential aspect of my work is that it soon began to touch on the question of one's view of the world and the relations between psychology and religion. I went into these matters in detail first in Psychology and Religion, published in 1938, and then, as a direct offshoot of this, in Paracelsica, published in 1942. Through Paracelsus, I was finally led to discuss the nature of alchemy in relation to religion and psychology. Or to put it another way, of alchemy as a form of religious philosophy. This I did in Psychology and Alchemy, published in 1944. Thus I had at last reached the ground which underlay my own experiences of the early years, for the process through which I had passed at that time corresponded to the process of alchemical transformation discussed in that book. It is only natural that I should constantly have revolved in my mind the question of the relationship of the symbolism of the unconscious to Christianity, as well as other religions. Not only do I leave the door open for the Christian message, but I consider it of central importance for Western man. It needs, however, to be seen in a new light, in accordance with the changes wrought by the contemporary spirit. Otherwise, it stands apart from the times and has no effect on man's wholeness. I have endeavored to show this in my writings. I have given a psychological interpretation of the dogma of the Trinity and of the text of the Mass, which, moreover, I compared with the visions described by a third-century alchemist and Gnostic. My attempt to bring analytical psychology into relation with Christianity ultimately led to the question of Christ as a psychological figure. As early as 1944, in Psychology and Alchemy, I had been able to demonstrate the parallelism between the Christ figure and the central concept of the alchemists, the lapis, or stone. The green gold, is the living quality which the alchemists saw not only in man, but also in inorganic matter. It is an expression of the life spirit who animates the whole cosmos. This spirit has poured himself out into everything, even into inorganic matter. He is present in metal and stone. My vision was thus a union of the Christ image with his analogue in matter. If I had not been so struck by the greenish gold, I would have been tempted to assume that something essential was missing from my Christian view. In other words, that my traditional Christ image was somehow inadequate, and that I still had to catch up with part of the Christian development. The emphasis on the metal, however, showed me the undisguised alchemical conception of Christ as a union of spiritually alive and physically dead matter. This investigation was rounded out by the Mysterium Conjunctionis, in which I once again took up the problem of the transference, but primarily followed my original intention of representing the whole range of alchemy as a kind of psychology of alchemy, or as an alchemical basis for depth psychology. In Mysterium Conjunctionis, my psychology was at last given its place in reality and established upon its historical foundations. Thus my task was finished, my work done, and now it can stand. The moment I touched bottom, I reached the bounds of scientific understanding, the transcendental, the nature of the archetype per se, concerning which no further scientific statements can be made. The survey I have given here of my work is, of course, only a brief summary. I really ought to say a great deal more, or a great deal less. The work is the expression of my inner development, for commitment to the contents of the unconscious forms the man and produces his transformations. My works can be regarded as stations along my life's way. I have never counted upon any strong response, any powerful resonance to my writings. They represent a compensation for our times, and I have been impelled to say what no one wants to hear. For that reason, and especially at the beginning, I often felt forlorn. I knew that what I said would be unwelcome, for it is difficult for people of our time to accept the counterweight to the conscious world. Today, I can say that it is truly astonishing that I have had as much success as been accorded me, far more than I ever could have expected. I have the feeling that I have done all that it was possible for me to do. Without a doubt, that life work could have been larger and could have been done better, but more was not within my power. Retrospect. I am satisfied with the course my life has taken. It has been bountiful and has given me a great deal. How could I ever have expected so much? Nothing but unexpected things kept happening to me. Much might have been different if I myself had been different. But it was as it had to be, for all came about because I am as I am. Many things worked out as I planned them to, but that did not always prove of benefit to me, but almost everything developed naturally and by destiny. I regret many follies which sprang from my obstinacy, but without that trait I would not have reached my goal, and so I am disappointed and not disappointed. I am disappointed with people and disappointed with myself. I have learned amazing things from people and have accomplished more than I expected of myself. I cannot form any final judgment, because the phenomenon of life and the phenomenon of man are too vast. The older I have become, the less I have understood or had insight into or known about myself. I am astonished, disappointed, pleased with myself. I am distressed, depressed, rapturous, I am all these things at once, and cannot add up the sum. I am incapable of determining ultimate worth or worthlessness. I have no judgment about myself and my life. There is nothing I am quite sure about. I have no definite convictions, not about anything, really. I know only that I was born and exist, and it seems to me that I have been carried along. I exist on the foundation of something I do not know. In spite of all uncertainties, I feel a solidity underlying all existence and a continuity in my mode of being. The world into which we are born is brutal and cruel, and at the same time, of divine beauty. Which element we think outweighs the other, whether meaninglessness or meaning, is a matter of temperament. If meaninglessness were absolutely preponderant, the meaningfulness of life would vanish to an increasing degree with each step in our development. But that is, or seems to me, not the case. Probably, as in all metaphysical questions, both are true. Life is, or has, meaning and meaninglessness. I cherish the anxious hope that meaning will preponderate and win the battle. When Lao Tzu says, "All are clear, I alone am clouded," he is expressing what I now feel in advanced old age. Lao Tzu is the example of a man with superior insight who has seen and experienced worth and worthlessness, and who at the end of his life desires to return to his own being, into the eternal, unknowable meaning. The archetype of the old man who has seen enough is eternally true. At every level of intelligence this type appears, and its lineaments are always the same, whether it be an old peasant or a great philosopher like Lao Tzu. This is old age and a limitation. Yet there is so much that fills me. Plants, animals, clouds, day and night, and the eternal in man. The more uncertain I have felt about myself, the more there has grown up in me a feeling of kinship with all things. In fact, it seems to me as if that alienation which so long separated me from the world has become transferred into my own inner world, and has revealed to me an unexpected unfamiliarity with myself.